My name is Jim Brandt, and I've been teaching a series that's been called Conversations with Fellow Travelers, and it's my way of entitling some sessions in which I try to get some conversation going among ourselves and with other persons of faith and hear some of their stories. Today, our focus will be on Maya Angelou, who is an African-American woman and novelist, best known for I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, but she's written a lot else. And Steve, you just read that novel recently, so if you want to interject anything from that novel at any point, that'd be apropos. I want to say just a little bit today about one of the themes that's been running through, just for some of you who haven't been with us. We've been doing a real variety of people. The first day we did St. Augustine from the 4th and 5th centuries, and the second day we jumped and did Julian of Norwich, who was a 15th century mystic. And then we've been working with a tape series that includes, a videotape series that includes Frederick Buechner, and James Carroll, and now Maya Angelou today. And one of the themes that's come through real strongly in, especially in the videotape, but it ties to what we've been doing all week, is the theme of remembering. Come on in. Glad to have you. The theme of remembering and how important that is. And in fact, when we get to today's video, we'll hear Maya Angelou say a little bit about how important remembering is. As a way to try to make some theological connection with that, I did some thinking about remembering and why that's important to the life of faith, how I might reflect on that theologically. And what I'd like to do is share something today about an understanding of sin. Most of the week I've been starting with grace, and so I thought maybe it's fair that, you know, this last day to start with sin instead and then do some theological analysis of sin and then move towards how remembering helps address the sin in our human condition. And I'm going to borrow from a famous analysis, that of Reinhold Niebuhr, which he develops particularly in his works, The Nature and Destiny of Man. We have a different title today, but that's the way it was titled then. And try to make some connection between what Niebuhr's analysis of sin and why remembering is so important to the life of faith. Niebuhr provides us with a real, I think, powerful, insightful analysis of the human condition in which he tries to make sense of sin. And when Niebuhr starts, he talks about human beings as, on the one hand, being self-transcendent. And what he means by that is that we human beings have a capacity to sort of go beyond ourselves and be something more, at least, than other creatures appear to be. And particularly here, he would be thinking about our self-consciousness. The fact not only that we can experience the world and experience simple things like taste and touch and smell, but we can also step back from those experiences and we can think about them. And we can step back another step and be aware of ourselves thinking about those things. And we have this possibility for to be self-transcendent. And another word that we might put in here is that goes with it is sense of freedom. That we have the ability to make, to not only to think about what we're going to do, but then decide what we want to do. So we have this sense of freedom that, as far as we know, other animals don't have in quite the same way that we do. So that's the one side of us that Niebuhr wants to establish first. And the other side that we'll put down here is in many ways the opposite of this, and that is that we not only are we free, but we're also finite. We have freedom, but it's not absolute freedom. We are finite, we are limited. We're limited to being in one time and place at a time. We're limited in being either male or female. We really kind of found a way exactly to be both. We're limited, maybe some of you would challenge me on that, I don't know, but we're limited in what we can do and what we can be. And so here we have something that sort of constrains our freedom. And this has much more to do with our particularity as persons, and the fact that we're limited. You know, one of the limitations that I became aware of a long time ago was that one of the dreams of my life I would never realize was to play in the NBA. You know, that just became clear that wasn't going to happen. So there's a silly example of my own finitude and how we're limited. Okay, so Niebuhr wants to say this is basically who we are. We as human beings are these sort of opposites that coexist, and there's some tension between them. And when we live as persons on one hand who are free and self-transcendent and self-aware, and on the other hand, limited and tied down, in a way, Niebuhr wants to say, put these two together, and this is the recipe for anxiety. Niebuhr sort of stands in the tradition of many early 20th century existentialists who want to look at human life, and when they do, one of the first things they see is anxiety. Now, where does that, or what could I say about that? Well, one of the things I'd want to say is that anxiety, of course, is related to fear, but it's different from fear. And I would express the difference this way, that fear has a particular object or happening that it's worried about. So I might be afraid that my spouse will leave me. You know, and that's a pretty particular kind of fear. And anxiety is a little different than that, because I think of anxiety as being more or less focused. Anxiety is that sense that something is going to go wrong, you know? It's not that I'm going to lose my notes exactly, but I'm just worried that in my session today, something is going to go wrong. And that's part of the terribleness, I think, of anxiety, because we don't know exactly what it is. And anxiety, I think, does flow out of this bipolar nature that we have, because on the one hand, we know we're free and we have to act, and we want to act in such a way that will lead us to happiness. But on the other hand, we're aware of our finitude, and we know that there's a lot of things we can't do. And so, you know, I never will play in the NBA, and there are a lot of other things that I might not be able to do, and yet I'm going to have to do something, because I know I'm a free agent who can go out and act and have some power to shape my life. And I'm anxious because I'm worried that somehow, in some creative new way, I'm going to mess it up. You know, and that's where that anxiety. So, this is sort of, real quickly, what the way Niebuhr thinks about the human condition. That we have these poles and they have this tension and they lead us to anxiety. We're worried about something going wrong in our lives. And then what happens out of that, says Niebuhr, and this is not altogether conscious by any means. In fact, a lot of what we're saying here, we'd be talking about subconscious workings of the psyche, of the soul. What happens is that we don't like this anxiety, and so what we do is we try to get out of who we are and escape from the anxiety by either going up here and denying, up here would be denying our self-transcendence, S-T, denying our self-transcendence. No, that's not the way I wanted to do it, but let's do it the other way. Let me erase that. Sorry. But on this side, I want to have denying our finitude. And pretending that we're not finite, we're just free. In other words, this side is really pretending that we have absolute freedom. It is pretending that we are God. And so the way that we could name this sin might be idolatry, which of course is one of the classic ways of naming sin is idolatry, because in a sense what we're doing over here when we do this is we're making ourselves into God. We're saying we're not really limited. We're really just totally free beings and we can do whatever we want. The other classic word that we would put here would be pride. And many theologians have said pride is really the root of all sin. It's this sense of independence and freedom, and I don't need God. Thank you. I can manage on my own very well. And so Niebuhr says this is one of the main forms that pride takes, that sin takes. And I maybe should have said here that anxiety. Niebuhr wants to say anxiety is not sin itself. Enough. He doesn't want to say that sin, that anxiety is a problem, but it's anxiety that puts us in the situation where sin becomes possible. So sin is, for Niebuhr, sin is when we get up here. Okay. Now on the other side, Niebuhr wants to say, instead of denying our finitude, we might also deny our self-transcendence. We might deny our freedom. And the name he gives to this one, you see, and it isn't the best name. What he calls it is sensuality. And by that he doesn't mean just, and this is why it's a kind of a misleading term, but he doesn't mean just throwing oneself into sensual pleasure. That's not what he means. What he means more is denying one's freedom, denying one's agency, and just sort of letting one being blown along by whatever is influencing one from outside. So, I decided, I don't like the word sensuality, so I decided to come up with my own word for over here. Instead of idolatry, I call it wormolatry. That's supposed to be funny.
yes.
Wormolatry. That is the sense that, see, over here, we're sort of making ourselves into God. We're making ourselves as if we were more than human.
over here, we're making ourselves, in a sense, less than human. Because we're denying our freedom. We're denying that we can really do anything to change our lives. We're sort of letting ourselves be blown by whatever winds are around us. And one of the things that this analysis, I think this is a really profound analysis and helps us. One of the ways it helps, I think, is that we've tended, in the history of theology, we've tended to be pretty clear about this sin over here. And you've probably heard a lot of sermons that get down on pride, get down on idolatry. I don't think we've done so good a job as recognizing that this can also be a problem for people. Over here, you see, what we've got is, in a sense, too much self. That's really the problem. Too much self. Over here, we've got too little self, in a sense. And why I think this is so important is that if we recognize this side, say, I'll pick on preachers because I am one, you know, the preacher who recognizes that idolatry and pride can be problems and preaches against idolatry and pride and really kind of wants to call people to account. If you're preaching that way, and the people who are hearing your sermon have this problem instead, it's a recipe for disaster. It's a recipe, I think, to beat down people who, in a sense, have already beaten themselves down. And so, for example, a lot of feminist thinkers have come along and said, you know, this analysis of Niebuhr is really helpful. And in many ways, they would say, it tends to be the case that this is men's problem, and this is women's problem, often. Now, I mean, don't say that that's absolute, because it's not. But there's a, I think generally it makes a lot of sense. And feminist theologians would say, one of the reasons that much traditional Christian theology does not work well for women is that it's missed out this part of the problem. And it's tried to help women by exploding their pride. Well, if you're trying to explode a person's pride who doesn't have pride, for whom that is a problem, I don't think that'll work. I think that, in fact, it'll be very counterproductive. Okay, so this to me is a real, I think there's a lot of insight here into the way we as human beings work and the way, and into the nature of the human condition and into the nature of sin and the different forms it can take. And I think it's real important to recognize that there are different forms of sin. And if that's the case, then when we move to grace, it needs to be able to be expressed differently so that it'll be appropriate to the people who are hearing it. Now, what does this have to do? This was supposed to have to do something with remembering. And now you say, well, what in the world does this have to do with remembering? Well, I think it has a lot to do. Because you see, the problem here is where you really get into sin, you see, is not the anxiety, but the denial. It's the denying. Or we might say, a kind of forgetting. It's not so much, I would suggest that sin, it's not so much that we have problems, but that we deny our problems, or we deny part of who we are. And so, part of the antidote, part of the answer, if this is the problem, I think that part of the answer is precisely remembering. I mean, why do we read scripture over and over again? Why do we hear, hopefully, a sermon regularly? Because we need again and again to remember the biblical story. And also, I think, to try to remember our own stories and hear them again, perhaps in a new way, and try to see if there are ways in which we are denying who we are, denying that we are, on the one hand, creatures, we are finite, but also creatures who are made in the image of God. See, and that's sort of the freedom side. And it seems to me that we can make a lot of sense out of what faith and theology are if we see them as about the business of seeing who we are as human beings. And I would suggest that we are creatures made in the image of God, and yet we have such profound and subtle ways to deny who we are and live instead in one of these forms of any comments or questions that you have about this analysis and the way it tries to understand the human condition and what sin is?
Are you going to talk more about how grace perhaps falls into a pattern or a model?
Yeah. Well, I can. What I would suggest just briefly is that our classical theology, say classical Lutheran theology, I mean, what's classical Lutheran theology? It's law and gospel, right? And I think in some ways that works pretty well over here. Because at least the way we've understood it is that law needs to address us in our idolatry and pride show us that we're really denying who we are, and then we're ready to hear a word of forgiveness. Over on this side, I'm not entirely clear about how exactly what grace does, but I think that grace I'm not sure what you do with law over here. I guess that's my question. I mean, grace is sort of affirming and saying, no, you're not, you are human, you're created in the image of God. I think this is a good question. I think there's a lot that needs to be thought about, but my sense is, as a beginning to an answer, is that over here, you probably need to start with affirmation and start with that sense of, well, as we did in last week, one evening, Joe Everson led us in, is our creed, in the "You are, so I am somebody," that sort of. I mean, that's, and in a way, you can see that this side is really more of an analysis of folks who are in some ways disenfranchised and who need to hear that grace. And the problem is, I think, that people who are over here, when they hear that word of judgment, it can knock them down, that word of the law, it can knock them down so far that they can't hear the grace anymore. And in a way, that's what I worry about. But I mean, that's a huge question, and there's sure a lot more that we could try to say about that. Yeah.
And there's one thing that I was ringing in my mind outside, and I don't know how it fits in with grace, but there's one section of the Bible, I don't know where it is, it's in the Gospels, where Christ talks about your gifts. And I never forget that. But when I talk to young people, I try to get them to understand. But basically what he says is that you have many gifts when you're a child. And he talks about the fact that the more you use, the more you get. And for a person who... And then he says the opposite. You don't use them, you lose them.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
And I see a person on this side as a person who needs to realize that he has all kinds of gifts.
Uh-huh.
But if they're not used, if he doesn't express himself as a fully human being, he loses even what he has.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that fits.
I think that fits. Because there is a sense here in which this person needs to be affirmed, but then this person also needs to recognize that they have the freedom to make some changes and to claim that for themselves and not to let themselves just be, I mean, they may have been oppressed over here, really oppressed, but the key then is for them to be affirmed and then be able to say, I'm going to claim my freedom and I'm going to move beyond that oppression. And I think that's, I hear that as similar to what you were
saying.
When I thought about law on the right side of the corner, it seems to me that Jesus often in the New Testament wants to interpret law as action, as calls to action, not just as do nots, but as do's, and that maybe some direction that one could get.
Yeah, and part of what that does is it expands us out of at least a narrow Lutheran reading of law, where we tend to read it very negatively, where the law is to convict us of sin, and it can do other things. And I think, I think that suggests that. Yes.
I'm kind of doing my own application back here.
Yeah, good.
I'm seeing anxiety in such a way, and it's unmanageable anxiety with schizophrenia. Unmanageable anxiety. And an accompanying problem is remembering the failure of historicity, the failure of learning from experience.
Yeah.
So I'm seeing remembering as great for a million person.
That fits with this, doesn't it? Because we're trying to say that somehow remembering is
also
part of the answer.
The locus of control. The internal locus of control on the prime autonomy, and then the external is formology.
Everything
else.
That's right.
I have no problem.
That's right. Yeah, good. Thank you. I really like when people can make connections with, because that helped me think that this really does make some sense. Okay, well, it's about time, so let's move on to the tape. And this is, I'll tell you, I cry almost every time I see this, so I think this is really powerful. That doesn't mean you have to cry, of course, but if you do, it's fine.
Stories, storyteller Maya Angelou, author of the classic I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, recreates her childhood world of Stamps, Arkansas. Through her story of Mama and Uncle Willie, Angelou points to the presence of God revealed in the ordinary experiences of the people she loves.
I open my mouth to the Lord and I won't turn back, no, I will go, I shall go, to see what the end is going to be. When I was young in a small town in Arkansas, about smaller than the exposed part of the stage, my grandmother used to say, what I'm doing, I will do this, and I'm standing out on His Word. I'm standing out on the Word of God. Well, I was young and very fanciful, so I could picture Mama standing out in the universe. All of them were swirling while the planets were swirling around her head, and she was just standing out on what seemed to be nothing, but was the Word of God. So I understood that to be faith. In that little town in Arkansas, my grandmother took me to church on Sunday. I don't mean she took me to church and then we left. We went to church all day Sunday, right on into the evening. And then Monday evening we went to missionary meeting. And Tuesday evening we went to choir practice. And Wednesday evening we went to prayer meeting. And Thursday evening we went to usher board. And Friday evening either deaconess board or visit the sick or both. We didn't go to church on Saturday. We just used that entire day to prepare to go to church on Sunday, the whole day. And at all those gatherings we sang, and I observed, I saw my people able to survive somehow. And I had to attribute it, their survival, to this faith which lifts one up. My grandmother, though, seemed to me to be God. I thought I knew it, and maybe she knew it, but no one else knew it. But when she would pray to God, and when the preachers, the good prayers, would pray to God, in story, God became the wind. God was the sunrise. God was the birds singing. So then that meant I could make direct connection with God rather than something ephemeral and, you know, way off someplace, left only for adults. I was sent to my grandma from California when I was 3. And I stayed with her until I was 13. She and her son, my uncle, who was crippled, raised me from 3 to 13. Mama was already old. She owned the only black-owned store in the town. But Mama had to use my brother and use me in the store. So my uncle started teaching me how to read and how to do my times tables. He was crippled. His whole right side was crippled. This side was huge, and he used to take me and hold me in front of the pot-bellied stove by my clothes back here. And he'd say, do your eights, or do your tenses. I did my eights. I did my tenses. Even now, in the middle of the night, after copious libation, I can be asked to do my twelveses. I have got my twelveses. I have those. I thought that if I didn't do them, my uncle would just open the door of that and only to find, of course, he was so tender-hearted, he wouldn't allow a spider or moth to be killed in the store where we lived. We lived store and house. In the 30s and 40s, the boys, as they were euphemistically called, the Klan, used to ride over into the black area. They didn't wear sheets. They had no need. They had no fear of being known. They would simply ride over and harass and maim and kill people because they didn't agree with the colors of their skin. My brother and I would watch out of the window after we had cleared the potato bin and the onion bin, not the section which separated them out. My uncle then would laboriously kneel, holding onto that cane, and roll over in the bin, and we would fill it with the potatoes and onions. And my uncle would lie there all night, moaning. And I could just almost see the tears going into the potato eyes, glistening like diamonds. My brother and I would then go to the window and look at the men. They all looked the same. Big, sounds better. Big guns that looked like theatrical props, I know now. Huge things that set like that.
When I see the survival of black Americans, the history of their survival, of our survival, having experienced conditions too bizarre to recount, and to know that their survival can be directly credited to their involvement and faith in God, then God as legend becomes not only important, but tangible and a piece of my history.
About 8 years ago, my uncle died. And I went down to Arkansas en route to Stamps. I met Miss Daisy Bates. Mrs. Bates is the black lady who led the children into the Little Rock High School, causing Orville Faubus, the then governor, to play the fool he was, and allowing President Eisenhower to send down federal troops to keep the peace or start some peace. She's a friend, so she met me and she said, "Girl, there's somebody who's just longing to talk to you. I'd like to bring him by your hotel this evening." So I said, "All right." She came with about maybe 10 people, but there was this one man, black man, just wonderful. I said, "How do you do?" He said, "I don't want to shake your hand, I want to hug you." I said, "Thank you very much. I shall appreciate it." So he gave me a hug. He said, "You're down here because Willie has died." Now, we were in Little Rock. Please picture Little Rock and picture the town I grew up in, 25 miles from Texas, southwest corner of the state. I had no idea that Little Rock was not less exotic than Buddha and Pest. Little Rock was way up north. It was where the elegant. And this man, so well dressed and so dignified, said, "Your Uncle Willie has died." In Stamps. I said, "You knew my Uncle Willie?" My Uncle Willie left Stamps, Arkansas twice in his life. Once he went to Hope, Arkansas, which is 30 miles away. And once in the 30s, he went to California to visit my father. He was so ashamed of his affliction, he would not leave the town. And this man, he said, "You know, because Willie has died, the state of Arkansas has lost a great man." I said, "Uncle Willie?" He said, "In fact, the United States has lost it. W.M. Johnson?" He said, "In fact, the world has lost a great man." I said, "But please tell me, what are you saying?" He said, "Well, because of your Uncle Willie, I'm who I am today." He said, "In the 20s, I was the only child of a blind mother, and your Uncle Willie gave me a job in your store, taught me to read, and made me learn my times table." So I asked him exactly how. He said, "He used to grab me." He said, "I guess you want to know who I am today." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I'm vice mayor of Little Rock, Arkansas." He went on to become the first black mayor of Little Rock. He said, "Now, by virtue of the power vested in me by the citizenry, I have a police escort for you downstairs." I went downstairs with Mr. Buckley, the mayor, and there were 8 men, white men. To look after me. And I thought of my Uncle Willie. And I thanked him. And I thanked him for his faith. Because dead, he was protecting me. Because of who he was. Because of the faith that he lived. And the love he showed constantly. I went to each of these men. I started to weep. I went to each one. I said, thank you in the name of my Uncle Willie. Thank you. The men deserved it. I couldn't stop. I shook hands with each of them. Then Mr. Bussey said, now when you get to Sam's, I want you to look up this fellow. He gave me a name. He said, he's a good old boy. He'll look after your property. He's a good lawyer. I went to Sam's, went into an office in Louisville, 3 or 4 miles away, expecting a middle-aged or middle-class black man. A young white man jumped up. He said, hello, Miss Andor, I'm just delighted to meet ye. He said, Mr. Bussey called me from Little Rock this morning. Mr. Bussey is the most powerful black man in the state of Arkansas. And more important than that, he's a noble man. Because of Mr. Bussey, I'm who I am today. So I sat down. I said, just give me a minute. And then he told me, he said, you see, I'm the only child of a blind mother. Mr. Bussey caught hold to me when I was 11 years old and made me love to learn. And I'm now in the state legislature. Do you see? So I look back at this crippled, black, poor man, hounded and haunted, who said, God is my salvation. Love is the bedrock upon which I stand. However he said it laboriously, but he lived it. So I wrote a song for him, which is a song sung by Miss Roberta Flack. Willie was a man without fame. Hardly anybody knew his name. Crippled and limping and always walking lame. He said, but I keep on moving. I'm moving just the same. Solitude was the climate in his head. Emptiness was the partner in his bed. Pain that crawled in the steps of his tread. He said, but I keep on following where the others led. I will cry and I will die, but my spirit is the surge of every spring. Look for me and you will see that I'm living in the games that children sing. People called him Uncle, Boy, and Hey. Said, you can't live through this another day. And then they waited to hear what he would say. He said, but I'm living in the games that children play. You may enter my sleep, people my dreams. You may threaten my early morning's ease. But I keep coming. I'm following. I'm laughing. I'm believing. I'm certain as a summer breeze. Ask for me. Call for me. My spirit is the surge of open seas. Look for me. Shout for me. I'm the rustle in the autumn leaves. When the sun rises, I am the time. When the children sing, I am the rhyme. Call me Willie. Call me Mr. Johnson. Call me Faith. That was written for my Uncle Willie.
Remembering takes courage. Because true remembering challenges the participant to go to the time and bring the time to this present. So when you really do it, all the odors, all the background sounds, all the textures are there again and new.
The most obvious point of commonality between Frederick Buechner and Maya Angelou and their reflections is the way in which they each start with death. What makes it storyteller like Frederick Buechner or a storyteller like Maya Angelou is so precious to us is that they can come before us. And before us, I show how it's possible not only not to deny that, but to deal directly with it, to confront it, to confront it with warmth, with humor, absolutely with pain. I mean, the pain written in both of their presentations was very palpable. And yet, clearly they were about drawing order out of the experience.
If a younger person goes to an older person with respect and says, Papa, Mama, Uncle, cousin, tell me, how was it with you in the 20s or 30s? What did you do in the Depression? How did you feel? And then sit there and listen. There will be repetitions, there will be contradictions, there will be the times when the person forgets, the older person forgets what the theme was or his subject matter was. But if you listen to her, you will begin to get a hook on your own story. On your own. And of course, then one can take that hook and begin to pull up on it inside one's own self. And I think my encouragement to everyone is pray.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't love them or judge them, but you don't call back and say, my kids are listening to you.
I hate to do this, but we need to at least have a formal kind of closure so that people that want to can go over to supper or whatever. But I really do want to encourage you in these kind of conversations. I know for me and for many of us, it's the opportunity to be with people and talk that's one of the richest parts of our experience here at Holden. And so I just want to encourage you to continue that through your time here. And I hope it will be rich and blessed for you as you talk with others about your journey of faith. And thanks for coming today.
Thank you.
Thank you.